This is Free Speech Radio News for Thursday, May 5, 2005. From KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. The House passes the final version of Bush's $81 billion war supplemental. Shantytown residents in Mumbai face massive evictions with nowhere left to turn. And today is Holocaust Remembrance Day. We'll hear from a German refugee. These stories and more after these headlines.
I'm Randy Zimmerman with the headlines for Free Speech Radio News. The World Health Organization is investigating a recent outbreak of polio in Indonesia that has now infected 4 children. From Jakarta, Maggie Margiono reports.
Indonesia's Minister of Health said even though Indonesia has been declared polio-free, vaccination programs continued until 2002. 3 years after the immunization program stopped, the virus emerged again. The Minister of Health is now conducting a vaccination campaign in epidemic areas and promises to revive the polio immunization program next month. However, medical experts worry that polio will spread through the community since the virus can spread in several weeks. Official reports indicate that the recent polio outbreak came from Nigeria, a country that has not yet been declared polio-free. But they are undertaking a comprehensive study to confirm those reports. Indonesia is also fighting several other dangerous epidemics like tuberculosis, malaria, ague, HIV, and scarlet fever. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Eric Klein reading for Maggie Margiono in Jakarta.
Palestinian authorities officially say that they are disappointed. The Israeli government is freezing the handover of West Bank towns to Palestinian security control. Israeli officials justify the action by claiming the Palestinian Authority refuses to disarm militants. The Israeli Director of Military Intelligence, Aaron Ze'evi, said that the PA is gradually reining in militants and has collected weapons in Jericho. Hundreds of thousands of Palestinians are set to vote today on what many are calling a referendum on the strength of groups like Hamas and Fatah. Manar Jabrin with the Independent Middle East Media Center has more.
Around 400,000 Palestinians will vote in the second stage of the local government elections in the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. 400 women among more than 2,500 candidates are competing for the 906 seats. In most regions, the competition is mainly between Fatah and Hamas, whereas in central West Bank areas, Fatah is competing against leftist groups like the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. These elections are the first local government elections since 1976. George Khair, a Palestinian voted.
This is the first local election in almost 30 years. This will be the first democratic competition that a whole generation will experience. Therefore, I encourage everyone to take part in this democratic process, which will contribute to the Palestinian cause.
The outcome of today's elections would mainly indicate how popular the Islamic movement Hamas is. For Free Speech Radio News from the International Middle East Media Center, IMEMC, in Palestine, this is Manar Jibrin.
Hundreds have been arrested in Egypt after multiple protests for greater democracy. Paul Shem reports from Cairo.
Thousands of members of the Muslim Brotherhood demonstrated across the country on Wednesday in the largest series of anti-government demonstrations witnessed in Egypt in the last 2 years. In Cairo, demonstrators called for increased democracy and described reform and freedom as religious duties. The protest comes 1 week after the Kafaya, or Enough, movement held its own series of protests around the country, calling for an end to President Mubarak's 24-year rule and for more democracy. Security sources say they arrested a total of 400 members of the Brotherhood, though the organization puts the number at closer to 1,000. In some provincial cities, demonstrators were dispersed with tear gas. Over the past year, there have been mounting calls for reform and increased democracy in the country, which has been ruled by a single party for the last half century. Next week, Parliament will present an amendment allowing for multi-candidate presidential elections, a move most activists say does not go far enough to reform the system. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Paul Shem in Cairo.
Thousands marched in front of the White House today, calling for the Bush administration to do more for people living with AIDS and HIV. Grace Cho reports from D.C.
This campaign, known as C2EA, is a vast new coalition of HIV-positive Americans, activists, and organizations, demanding that world leaders take proven steps to stop the epidemic in the U.S. and abroad. Thousands participated at the Walk a Mile in My Shoes march, and the crowd then lined more than 8,000 pairs of shoes in the shadow of the White House, symbolizing those who die every day around the world from AIDS. At the same time, the campaign held events in a dozen cities protesting to halt the epidemic worldwide. Julie Davis, an executive director of Community HIV-AIDS Mobilization Project and also with the Campaign to End AIDS, says more.
The Campaign to End AIDS has the roadmap to end AIDS. We're bringing it to the White House today and taking it through every state this fall through caravans that are going to link people with HIV and their loved ones, showing how we are ending AIDS. And we're telling our leaders that we need their support.
Activists also say that federally funded abstinence-only programs have threatened two decades of significantly proven HIV prevention. For Free Speech Radio News in Washington, D.C., I'm Eun-Young Cho.
And I'm Randy Zimmerman for Free Speech Radio News.
Today, the House of Representatives passed the final version of President Bush's $82 billion war supplemental request for the continuing presence of the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan. The passage comes as a U.S. Inspector General reports that the U.S. cannot account for $100 million for Iraqi reconstruction. The controversial anti-immigration measure known as the Real ID Act was added to the supplemental request. The act, among other things, would prohibit states from issuing driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants, although a controversial plan to allow bounty hunters to capture undocumented immigrants was stripped out of the bill. Mitch Jezerich reports.
The $82 billion supplemental war request does contain funds for humanitarian endeavors. It would spend over $1 billion on reconstruction in Afghanistan, another billion on tsunami relief, and $240 million for international food aid. There is even some money for Palestine. But $75 billion of the bill goes to maintain the military presence in Iraq and Afghanistan. Republican Representative Bill Young of Florida.
The increases that we have added in this bill go to the urgently needed items such as ammunition, weapons, up-armored Humvees.
I want to make quite clear, I will support this bill because I feel that I have no choice but to participate in cleaning up a mess which somebody else left.
Representative David Obie of Wisconsin is the ranking Democrat on the House Appropriations Committee.
But I don't relish it. I believe that the entire operation in Iraq has been accompanied by incredibly naive romanticism on the part of the White House.
Passage of the supplemental war request comes as the U.S. Special Inspector General for Iraqi Reconstruction reports that over $100 million in reconstruction money is unaccounted for. There are no provisions in the $82 billion bill to increase oversight on how the money will be spent. Democratic Representative Barbara Lee of Oakland is one of only 58 lawmakers to vote against the bill.
How can we sign off on this check when our own government reported yesterday that yet another $100 million cannot be accounted for? This is on top of the $9 billion from last year that's still missing. And how can we sign this check if the Bush administration has offered no plan to bring our troops home?
Thinking long term, the measure provides $592 million to build the world's largest embassy in Baghdad and much more to build military bases throughout Iraq. Democratic Representative Dennis Kucinich of Ohio.
Today, our majority party is advocating sending billions more to Iraq to keep our troops there indefinitely. Instead of winding down operations in Iraq, today the administration will receive money to help build permanent military bases in Iraq.
The final supplemental request includes the controversial immigration measure, the Real ID Act, which would prohibit states from issuing standard driver's licenses to undocumented immigrants. Republican Chair of the House Judiciary Committee James Sensenbrenner is the sponsor of the bill.
These provisions will hamper the ability of terrorists and criminal aliens to move freely through our society by requiring that all states require proof of lawful presence in the U.S. for their driver's licenses to be accepted as identification for federal purposes, such as boarding a commercial airplane, entering a federal building, or a nuclear power plant.
A controversial provision to allow bounty hunters to capture undocumented immigrants was stripped out of the Real ID Act. Still, the measure increases the burden of proof on immigrants who are applying for political asylum to show that they would be persecuted if returned to their home country. The bill also allows for the deportation of an immigrant who sends money to a so-called terrorist organization, even if the State Department does not recognize it as a terrorist group. Jean Butterfield is executive director of the American Immigration Lawyers Association.
The government can later come and say, oh, but you should have known that that organization was a terrorist organization. And if you can't prove that you didn't know or shouldn't have been expected to know that that group really was a terrorist group in some of its arms or wings, then you are deportable.
The Real ID Act also mandates the completion of a 14-mile fence on the Mexican-San Diego border. The bill mandates the Homeland Security Department to waive all labor and environmental laws so to complete the fence. The Senate is expected to give its final approval to the $82 billion supplemental request and the Real ID Act early next week. Mitch Jezerich, Free Speech Radio News.
House Republicans introduced legislation today that would make it more difficult for agencies to receive funding for Head Start programs. Republicans argue that widespread mismanagement of Head Start funds make reform necessary. However, the legislation will make it easier for faith-based organizations to receive funds for their Head Start programs. Dolores M. Bernal has more from the Capitol.
2005 marks the 40th anniversary of the Head Start program.
Head Start is available to low-income children across the country in every community. It serves over 900,000 children. Most of those children are concentrated in 4- and 5-year-old preschool programs, but we also have Early Head Start, which serves children 0 to 3.
Manda Lopez Klein works with the Migrant Seasonal Head Start Association, a group that helps provide Head Start to the children of migrant farm workers who pick our fruits and vegetables.
Migrant farm worker children are really critical. Their needs are very critical because of the mobile nature of their families and because of the low-income background that they come from. Their families work very hard, 10, 12-hour days, and still don't make minimum wage. Many times families arrive in communities where fortunately there is a migrant seasonal Head Start program, and we're able to care for their children from sunup to sundown, sometimes 6 and 7 days a week, including holidays, 4th of July, Memorial Day, those days, because families don't get those days as holidays.
But now groups such as this one and many others that receive grants for Head Start programs from the Department of Health and Human Services may be facing a new layer of bureaucracy that will make it harder for them to provide these services.
We are going to introduce today our Head Start authorization bill.
Republican Congressman John Boehner of Ohio is the chairman of the House Education and Workforce Committee, the same committee that drafted the No Child Left Behind Act. Now, Mr. Boehner, along with other Republicans, are calling to reform how Head Start programs get their funding. Boehner says that the current process is inadequate, an assessment that Republicans are using from a report that was issued last March by the Government Accountability Office, or GAO. The GAO report warned that the financial control system in Head Start is failing. Congressman Boehner.
The GAO found that the financial management weaknesses in Head Start are resulting in diminished services for disadvantaged children. GAO further recommended that the federal government take steps to recompete grants that are currently awarded to poorly performing grantees.
According to the National Head Start Association, the GAO report is flawed and exaggerated. The association says that there are actually few grantees that mismanage Head Start funds. The new legislation introduced today will raise the standard by requiring more oversight and greater scrutiny of those who compete for funds. On the other hand, Republicans also want to make it easier for faith-based organizations to compete and receive these grants without having to adhere to discrimination prohibitions.
We believe that faith-based providers ought to be able to participate in these programs without giving up their rights under Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964. But as we all know, this is a divisive issue. We've dealt with it in committee. We've dealt with it on the floor. And while it's not in the bill, we expect that before it leaves the House, it will be.
Not having to obey Title VII means that faith-based organizations can refuse to hire someone who is not Christian. Sarah Green is the president of the National Head Start Association. She opposes preferential treatment and exceptions to faith-based groups.
There are faith-based organizations that have operated Head Start for over 100 years, do an excellent job. But I don't think they should have a priority over a community-based or a school system or community action or any other type of grantee. It should be open competition to any qualified organization.
The controversial debate over the future of Head Start will continue for the next few weeks. For advocates like Manda Lopez, it's not a question of how the funds will flow, but if they will flow.
There are thousands of children who are in need of Head Start who still don't have it. And we want to make sure that, you know, I know one of the questions you asked was, are we going to see more money in the program? That's one of the things that we'd like to see. And we need to continue to be a voice for those families who haven't had the opportunity to have a Head Start experience.
Dolores Bernal, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
In Mumbai, India, about 60% of the city's 12 million people live in shanties. Most of these illegal structures are developed by slumlords with tacit support from political leaders. Earlier this year, the government started a demolition drive to remove these shanties. With more than 300,000 people facing demolition and with no land available in the near vicinity, the political parties are set to face angry and irritated voters in the coming municipal elections. FSRN correspondent Binu Alex reports from Mumbai.
The manner in which they demolished our homes, children, pregnant women, and aged people all were thrown on the streets mercilessly.
Madhu Ghatke is one of the many victims whose shanty has been demolished overnight in Mumbai. For the majority of those evicted, there was no advance notice. The evictions were quickly and violently carried out, leaving no time to salvage personal belongings.
Where can we go? We will not vacate this place unless we are given alternative housing. We are evicted only to build high-rise buildings for the rich. How can you throw out the poor in this way?
The government should have come with an alternative plan, because in the directive principles and in the constitution, providing a home is an equal fundamental responsibility of the state.
Dolphy D'Souza represents Voice of the Exploited, an organization working for the poor in Mumbai. Human rights activists worry that instead of developing a comprehensive policy and strategy to address the housing of the poor, the government is totally ignoring the issue.
60% of the people who stay in Mumbai today are living in slums. So who else are you going to knock off in the process of saying that you want a Shanghai here? You know, the Voice of the Exploited thinking was very clear that we don't want the Shanghai on the debris of the poor man.
The Mumbai corporate world, however, maintains that the city has exceeded its limit in both population and infrastructure. It just can't afford to have more people. Bombay First is an association of corporate bodies that has presented the plan Vision Bombay to make Mumbai a city with better amenities. Narinder Nair is the chairman of Bombay First. Nair says that if China's Shanghai can turn around, Mumbai also has the potential.
All I can say at the moment, we are seeing a little bit of political will to do something. So this is your city where you get the golden eggs. And if you let the city be destroyed and you do not have people will move out, whatever business hunter will move out, the city will become, will decay.
As part of the agreement, the government has agreed to build housing for those living in slums prior to 1995. But the chief minister has clarified that it will not be free. From Mumbai in India, Benu Alex for Free Speech Radio News.
This summer, Israel plans to forcibly remove thousands of Israeli settlers from the occupied Gaza Strip as part of its disengagement plan. Meanwhile, settler attacks on Palestinian communities in the West Bank are escalating. Last month, residents of Tuwani, a Palestinian village in the southern West Bank region of Hebron, reported that Israeli settlers from the nearby Maon settlement spread poison in grazing pastures of sheep owned by local Palestinians. Since then, 28 sheep have died and 80 are sick from the poisoning. From Tuwani, Marcel Hopkins and Manar Jibrin filed this report.
On a warm, windy spring day, dozens of international and Israeli peace activists gather in the Palestinian village of Tuwani to help clean up poisoned pastures threatening the local sheep and wildlife. Aranom, a Jewish Israeli, wears rubber gloves and a face mask as she picks through shrubbery looking for the poison pellets.
Right now I'm in Susia, where the settlers spread the poison that killed many animals, wild animals and also domestic animals of the Palestinians. I'm here to collect the poison and to protect the Palestinians from the settlers and from the Israeli army. while they are collecting the poison that killed their animals.
Aranam says the poisoning is just one of many ways that Israeli settlers attack Palestinian villagers in Tuani.
The settlers attack them inside their houses, they attack them inside their fields, they spread the poison, they just come and they beat them, sometimes kill them with guns, threaten them, and the army just protect the settlers and help the settlers, usually.
This violence began more than 20 years ago, shortly after the first caravans of Israelis arrived to form the Ma'on settlement near Tuani. But it drastically escalated in 1999 with the establishment of Havat Ma'on, an illegal outpost that was dismantled by the Israeli military and re-inhabited by settlers months later. Last year, Israeli settlers from Havat Ma'on attacked a 72-year-old woman who was alone in her fields. Her son Hafez says this is common.
The settlers attacked old people, attacked the children, attacked all the people, really. Every family here has an experience with the settlers.
When Israeli settlers started attacking students walking to the Tuani Primary School from nearby villages, residents invited international peace groups to the village, hoping their presence would deter attacks. Luna, a member of the North American-based Christian peacemaker teams, says the settlers also target the internationals.
When we first started accompanying the children, we were attacked by five mass settlers with bats, and the one that was hospitalized had a punctured lung and other injuries, and the other person had a broken arm and a damaged knee.
As a result of this attack, the Israeli parliament ordered the Israeli military to escort the children to school. Parents in Tuani say children suffer from symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder, including frequent nightmares, bedwetting, and severe anxiety. 12-year-old Safiya says the settlers place toys armed with explosives along the road to school.
Mr. Prof. We feel scared. We feel very afraid that the settlers will set a bomb for us on the road to school. They attack us. They beat us and set traps for us. They put a bag of money on the road with a bomb inside it, and when someone picks it up, it explodes.
Israeli settler violence extends beyond physical assault on people. Tuani residents register almost daily complaints of settlers destroying their property and means of livelihood. Local farmer Hafez says the settlers often uproot his olive trees.
Last year, they pulled up 50 olive trees from Tuani, close to our house, and we planted again. And so, before 1 month, they came another time, they pulled up 150 olive trees.
Despite the uprooted trees, poisoned land and water sources, burned crops, and wounded and traumatized children, the Palestinians say their resolve to stay in their ancestral village remains intact. They believe the settlers attack with the intention of forcing them off the land. But instead of fleeing, the Tuani people regroup, replant, and rebuild. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Marcel Hopkins with Manar Jibrin in Tuani, occupied Palestinian territories.
The debate over academic freedom continues in Colorado as an academic bill of rights was killed in the Colorado House of Representatives yesterday. FSRN's Maeve Conran reports.
Senate Bill 85, introduced in January of this year, would have required the protection of intellectual independence for professors, researchers, and students, as well as the expression of ideas free from interference by legislators. Bill sponsor, Democratic Representative Angie Piccioni.
There is a problem in higher education in Colorado. We all know it. That problem is that there's been a chilling effect put on academic freedom. And because of that, we are losing good professors.
The bill started out in January, but before its first hearing, the controversy surrounding CU professor Ward Churchill erupted. The four-year-old essay written by Churchill on 9/11 led to calls by legislators to reassess the system of tenureship and to restrict academic freedom. Governor Bill Owens called for Churchill to be fired. CU officials said Churchill's comments are protected by the First Amendment. However, Churchill remains under official review over allegations of plagiarism and that he falsely claimed Native American heritage. This has created a climate that stifles academic freedom and excellence, say bill sponsors. Again, Angie Piccioni.
People who have been offered positions in our universities and our flagship universities and who have turned them down because of the culture and climate in this state around higher education. We need to fix that. This is one step in the direction of fixing that so that we can keep the best and brightest.
Environmental studies professor Adrian Anderson is also accusing the university of bowing to political pressure in their decision not to renew her contract. Anderson, who's worked as a whistleblower on cases involving corporations such as Lockheed Martin and Coors, accuses CU of trying to silence her community service research.
The public has the right to know this information, and if they can't get it through a faculty member at the university, then their chances of getting it at all are going to be even less.
Although Anderson is untenured, the issue of tenureship has been central to the debate. Owens and other conservative lawmakers say the system makes it too difficult to fire professors. However, supporters of the tenure system say that's why it is important. It's designed to protect academic freedom for professors. Critics of Senate Bill 85 objected to the language that limited the legislature's power to interfere with academic freedom at higher education institutions. Although the bill sponsors agreed to strike this from the bill, Republicans still find fault. Republican Kevin Lundberg.
This bill covers over a wound that needs to be fixed, that needs to be cured. And we can do that, but we can't do it by just saying everything's fine. We need to dig deeper and find the real fundamental issues.
The bill failed by 5 votes. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Maeve Conran in Boulder, Colorado.
It is Holocaust Remembrance Day, which honors the up to 12 million Jews, Poles, Roma, homosexuals, and disabled people who were massacred by the Nazis. After the Third Reich came into power in Germany in 1938, it became nearly impossible for Jews and other persecuted groups to leave the country. In 1961, German refugee Edith Hoffman spoke with Byron Bryant at Pacifica's KPFA about life in Germany after the time Hitler became chancellor in 1933.
The thing that startled us most was that about 4 days after the Nazis came to power, two young men of our community, a small health resort near Frankfurt am Main, had left Germany. They must have had passports, which is already unusual. Most people don't have passports in Europe unless they want to go somewhere. And one had gone to Holland, I think, and the other was on his way to Palestine. And everybody among the Jewish citizens joked about it, thought, my God, how easily are they scared of? And then I talked to one of the brothers of one of them, the one to Holland, and he said, Heinz couldn't stand the humiliation. He does not want to live with dishonor. And the other one went to Palestine, so he must have been influenced by Zionist ideas. And but this was only possible to people who had a passport. And from that day on, you couldn't easily get, you couldn't get a passport anymore for a trip. You know, you had to leave. And everybody thought this was hasty because we've had many different governments in Germany, and it came and went. And the Nazis couldn't possibly last. A lot of Germans were not Nazis too. This is the lunatic fringe. He's just a drummer. They always use that expression, Hitler, Trommler. The more moderate people will soon calm him down because it was a coalition government at that time with Hugenberg, the German nationals, Deutsche Nationale, conservative. They were anti-Semitic too, but not actively so.
Again, that was Edith Hoffman, a German refugee, speaking in 1961 about the conditions in Germany post-1933. Free Speech Radio News is produced at Pacifica stations KPFK in Los Angeles and KPFA in Berkeley and community radio station WMNF in Tampa, Florida. Visit our website, www.fsrn.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Aura Bogado.